Sean's raid, Southern steps towards secession. At one point he shouted in despair, "My God, are calamities never to come singly?" He gave the impression of being timid and useless, and hence, dangerous. Philosophically, he was trapped in what became known as Buchanan's dilemma. He did not think the Southern states could legally secede from the Union, but as a lawyer and strict constitutionalist, he saw no legal way he could intervene in the dispute. He believed that if any agency of the federal government should address the matter, it should be Congress. No one in his inner circle was helpful. John C. Breckinridge, his vice president, was a Kentuckian who had become a Confederate general. Dominating Buchanan's cabinet were scheming Southerners. Five ultimately resigned, others threatened to step down, and one, Edwin Stanton, was actually an informant for the Republicans. Buchanan remained overlooked, unaware of details, depressed by events beyond his control. He vacillated month after month, hoping the critical decisions could be deferred until after he left office. When three Southern commissioners came to Washington in 1861 and pressed Buchanan for assistance, the president exclaimed, "You don't give me time to consider. You don't give me time to say my prayers. I always say my prayers when required to act upon any action belonging to Congress." The nation was only a month before the explosion of war when Lincoln took the presidential oath. Buchanan remarked that if Lincoln was as glad to get into the White House as he himself was to get out of it, Lincoln must be the happiest man alive. Buchanan the Blunderer, as the press labeled him, departed Washington convinced that he had done well in his tenure of office. "I acted for some time as a breakwater between the North and the South, both surging with all their force against me." No human wisdom, he thought, could have prevented the process of degeneration during the 1850s. He had done his best, and he firmly believed that posterity would do him justice. He returned to Wheatland, his home in Lancaster. Six servants saw to his needs, and visitors came frequently. Buchanan was a good Unionist during the war years, never speaking out against what he considered Lincoln's repeated violations of the Constitution. In 1865, he joined the Presbyterian Church, which he had previously regarded as too abolitionist. Yet voices continued to be raised against him. Despite his voluminous mail, Congress took away his franking privileges. Buchanan's opposition to the Emancipation Proclamation brought a new rash of enemies. His endorsement of a Peace Democrat candidate, who would allow the South to re-enter the Union with its pre-war slave status intact, appeared to many as political suicide. Only Richard Nixon matched Buchanan's after-the-fact effort to rehabilitate a failed presidency. The Pennsylvanian toiled long over his memoirs. Since no former associates would help him, he hired a ghostwriter. Mr. Buchanan's Administration on the Eve of the Rebellion was published in 1868. The book was notable for the attention paid to Northern anti-slavery agitation and the malign influence of the Republican Party as major causes of the Civil War. Naturally, the memoirs exonerated Buchanan of any wrongdoing, and their publication brought forth another torrent of remonstrance. On June 1st of that year, Buchanan died of pneumonia. The day before his passing, he declared, "I have no regret for any public act of my life, and history will vindicate my memory." The problem was, no one wanted to write about him. The first biography of James Buchanan did not appear until a full 101 years after he left the presidency. Andrew Johnson, One Vote from Impeachment. No one, not even Abraham Lincoln, has ever reached the White House from more humble beginnings than Andrew Johnson. Born to dirt-poor parents in North Carolina and orphaned early in life, Johnson never attended school. He was apprenticed at the age of 10 to a tailor. Later, he taught himself to read. His wife, Eliza, taught him to write and do simple arithmetic. He would become a voracious reader, spending a great deal of his time in Washington perusing tomes in the Library of Congress. After moving to eastern Tennessee, Johnson opened his own tailor shop. He married Eliza and fathered 5 children, and he was able to save money by stern thrift. Of medium height and size, he was dark-complexioned with black hair and eyes. Probably because of his tailoring profession, Johnson was always neatly dressed. He was usually courteous, but he could be crude both in thought and in diction. That he never allied himself with any church was something that people held against him. His political career followed the usual path: state legislature, House of Representatives, governor, and U.S. Senate. Although he was reticent by nature, he came alive with fire and thunder on the stump. At every level of government, he displayed high principles, refusing help from financial backers and political bosses. However, he was so strongly opinionated that he would argue with anyone, including members of his Democratic Party. During the secession crisis of 1860-61, he alone among all Southern senators remained in the upper chamber. He viewed the exodus of the Southern states to be treason and nothing but treason. That left him in an uneasy no-man's land. Southerners considered him a traitor. Northerners regarded him with distrust. That did not stop Lincoln from appointing Johnson military governor with the rank of brigadier general in 1862, by which time federal forces occupied a large section of Tennessee. Johnson carried out his duties in a near dictatorial fashion. He impressed slaves, suspended newspapers, confiscated horses for the army, and drafted a loyalty oath stronger than that demanded by the Union government. Tennessee became the first of the Confederate states to later qualify for readmission to the Union. In the 1864 national election, Republicans temporarily adopted the name National Union Party for broader appeal. The leading war Democrat, Johnson, was chosen as vice presidential candidate. His political downfall began shortly thereafter, at the March 1865 inauguration ceremonies. That morning, he had a hangover as well as lingering effects from a recent bout with typhoid fever. Johnson asked for a stimulant prior to taking the oath of office. He downed 2 glasses of whiskey and then delivered rambling, sometimes incoherent remarks, which were described by one newspaper as the spewings of a drunken boor. Another editor shuddered that one frail life stands between this insolent, clownish creature and the presidency. A month after this national embarrassment, Johnson became President of the United States. In almost every way, he was unqualified for the office. He was a staunch states writer who championed the poor man. The very qualities that made Lincoln persuasive, especially tact and common sense, were notably lacking in Johnson. He could not compromise, hence, in this era, he could not lead. Dazed at first by the suddenness of his elevation, Johnson did little more than issue reassurances that Lincoln's lenient peace plans would be followed. That he kept Lincoln's cabinet intact was additional evidence of that intent. However, the question of what to do with the South sharply divided the cabinet. Seward supported Lincoln's policies, while Stanton headed the radical faction. Johnson's 3 years and 11 months in the White House consisted of open warfare with the Congress. The president advocated a conciliatory reunion of states. Radicals wanted vengeance on the South. Johnson quickly concluded that radical Republicans were bent on destroying the Constitution, and he saw it as his patriotic duty to fight to preserve it. He grew increasingly abrasive because he was certain his adversaries were wicked men out to destroy him. In an 1866 speechmaking tour, he responded to hecklers by exchanging insults with them. The dignity of the high office sank to the gutter. His strident opposition to the radical Republicans had an inevitable result. Never before had Congress overridden a presidential veto, yet Johnson's term saw an oft-repeated pattern. Congress would pass a law, Johnson would veto it, and Congress would override the veto by a large margin. Shortly after the 1867 Military Reconstruction Act, vetoed in vain, placed the South under military occupation, Johnson retaliated by firing Secretary of War Stanton for corruption. The House of Representatives retaliated by drawing up charges to impeach the president. The 45-day trial was a farce. Johnson's high crimes and misdemeanors, as the Constitution defines justification for impeachment, were his not agreeing with the will of Congress. The flimsiness of the 11 articles of indictment reflected how cocksure the radicals were of their case. In the end, Johnson escaped impeachment by a single vote. The outcome saved the authority and eminence of the presidency. Had impeachment passed, no future president would feel safe quarreling with a majority of the House of Representatives and 2/3 of the Senate. However, Johnson's victory was pyrrhic. For the remainder of his term, he and Congress were at loggerheads. Johnson interfered with no army policies. General-in-Chief Grant remained in charge of executing Reconstruction laws, and he ran the army as if the president did not exist. After both parties scorned him in 1868, Johnson returned home. He survived an 1873 cholera attack and accepted appointment in 1875 to return to the U.S. Senate. On the last day of July, however, he died from a second stroke within 48 hours. His remains were wrapped in an American flag and buried with a copy of the Constitution as his pillow. Andrew Johnson was hardworking and honest. He was also hot-headed and contentious. As an accidental president, he failed to measure up to the demands of the office to which he could not have been elected in the first place. Historians place him beside Buchanan on the short list of presidential failures. Ulysses Simpson Grant, good in war, poor in peace. No major American figure displays a more disheartening contrast in leadership between war and peace than Ulysses Simpson Grant. Anyone who knew him before the Civil War might have predicted this dichotomy, since he failed at every venture he tried outside the military. The aggression that he showed in a series of Union victories, both in the West and the East, evaporated on election to the White House, where his laxity led to an administration that was dogged by accusations of corruption. For this reason, the first of the four Union military commanders to become president has long been considered the worst of them. Born to a leather-making family in 1822, he was one of six children. His christened name was Hiram Ulysses, but when he arrived at West Point, a clerical error listed him as Ulysses Simpson Grant. Cadets called him Uncle Sam Grant, and friends thereafter knew him as Sam. Excellence in horsemanship outweighed his mediocrity as a cadet and enabled him to graduate from the academy. One of his close friends, James Longstreet, introduced his cousin, Julia Dent, to Grant, and the two subsequently married. Each brought a lifetime of love and stability to the other. Alone and depressed while doing frontier duty in California, Grant turned to the bottle. In 1854, after being caught drunk in public, he involuntarily resigned from the Army. For 5 years, he failed at every civilian task he undertook. The coming of the Civil War found Grant working in his father's leather goods shop in Galena, Illinois, where he had trouble even remembering prices. Grant, so far, was hardly a Horatio Alger success story. 3 months passed before he received the colonelcy of a recalcitrant regiment that no one else wanted. For the silent, unpretentious officer, a steady climb to fame ensued. Grant stood 5'8" tall and weighed 135 pounds. Stooped and round-shouldered, he had the expression, as one observer described, of a man who had come way up from very far down. Grant had more than his share of quirks. He commanded in a dozen major battles, yet the sight of blood made him queasy. Any meat he ate had to be well done. Despite witnessing the cruelty that army horses had to endure, Grant had a strong affection for all animals. His favorite breakfast was cucumbers soaked in vinegar. Like Stonewall Jackson, Grant was tone deaf. Lincoln once asked him what his favorite song was, and Grant replied, "I know only two songs. One is Yankee Doodle, and the other isn't." His daily consumption of 12 to 15 cigars later had fatal consequences. National recognition came early in 1862 after his forces captured Fort Donelson, Tennessee. His stern demand for the garrison's capitulation earned him a new nickname, Unconditional Surrender Grant. Subsequent victories at Shiloh, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga made him the Union's most successful field commander. To criticism made of Grant after the terrible losses at Shiloh, Lincoln responded, "I can't spare this man. He fights." On March 10, 1864, Lincoln named Grant General-in-Chief of all Union armies, with the resurrected rank of Lieutenant General, a rank held only by the sainted Washington. Grant's subsequent 10-month campaign against Robert E. Lee's army ended the war at Appomattox. Grant then displayed a surprising humanity. Perhaps because he had known defeat in pre-war years, Grant sympathized with Lee and his beaten legions. The federal general's lenient surrender terms enabled former Confederates to go home with dignity. This was a first vital step toward national reconciliation. Grant was now the nation's foremost hero, trailed by crowds wherever he went. Such adulation propelled him into political realms he should have avoided. This was a man who had voted only once in his life. That made no difference to the adoring public. In 1868, Grant probably could have received the presidential nomination from either party. And as a Republican, he won the election by a landslide. He ran on the simple slogan, "Let us have peace." What followed, asserted one historian, was 8 years in blunderland that are regarded as a national disgrace. However, hero-worshipping American voters elevated Grant to the presidential chair and deserved to shoulder much of the blame for what followed. Grant entered the White House in the Gilded Age when the country's growth ran high and wealth was amassed in stupendous fortunes. Corruption, to some degree, was inevitable. Under Grant, it flourished. He knew nothing about politics and made no effort to find out. Family members packed the government. Old army cronies got civilian appointments with no more knowledge than the president had. The 18th chief executive became an easy tool for designing politicians as well. Grant viewed his position as that of an administrator, not a leader. His blind loyalty to discredited cronies established a record for scandal and moral rottenness not equaled even by Warren Harding's infamous regime. Re-elected by an even higher margin in 1872, Grant interpreted the victory as a mandate to continue governing in his slapdash manner. That would lead shortly to the Panic of 1873 and a depression that lasted 6 years. Only Hamilton Fish's admirable achievements as Secretary of State stand out among the sordid record. After his presidency, Grant spent 2 years being feted by the crowned heads of Europe. He returned home and barely missed being nominated for president a third time. Yet in 1884, all his money was invested in a brokerage firm that suddenly went bankrupt, and he was left humiliated and penniless. Congress restored him to full general's rank with retirement pay, but the stipend was not enough to cover his mounting bills. A friend, Mark Twain, stepped forward with an offer and large advance for Grant's memoirs. Seeking to provide for his family, the hero eagerly went to work. Midway through the task, Grant began experiencing stabbing pain in his throat. Diagnosis revealed inoperable cancer. Completing his memoirs now became a race against time. Grant spent 9 months working feverishly. He dictated to a stenographer until the malignancy choked off his voice. Then he turned to writing text. Physicians prescribed morphine and cocaine to ease the pain, but the opiates also beclouded his memory. The warrior died July 23, 1885, only 7 days after completing the manuscript. Grant's 2-volume War Recollections were published later the same year. The work proved to be one of the most successful titles of the 19th century, notwithstanding its controversial conclusions and personal judgments. Grant's brilliance as a general would be sterling were it not blemished by his ignorance as a president. In an exploding country awash with wealth, his solution was to leave the spigot turned on full blast. Though he was sadly lacking as commander-in-chief, his gifts as chief of the Union Army and contributions to national unity put him among the military's greats. Rutherford Burchard Hayes, President of Reconciliation. One of the ironies of American history is that a man of impeccable honesty is the winner of the most dishonest presidential election on record. Once Rutherford Burchard Hayes was in office, however, his putting an end to Reconstruction helped heal wounds in the South, and his efforts to reform civil service removed the taint of corruption left after 8 years of U.S. Grant cronyism. By the end of his one term, he proved to be the tonic that the country needed. Hayes was born in Ohio, graduated from Harvard Law School, and was a practicing attorney in Cincinnati when the Civil War began. He was then 38, with 3 children. He had no military experience, but did have an abiding love for the Union. "My belief in this war," he told his family, "is as deep as any faith can be." Hayes enlisted in the 23rd Ohio, the 1st Buckeye Regiment to organize for 3 years of duty. In time, he came to command the unit. Long conversations with experienced officers, plus close contact with the men in the ranks, led Hayes to say that he was one of the good colonels in the great army. He found military command responsibilities to be a pleasing contrast to the dullness of civilian careers. Except for the 1863 Battle of South Mountain, Maryland, Hayes saw action only in western Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. He aided in the capture of Confederate Colonel John Hunt Morgan's troopers in the 1863 Ohio Raid, and gallant action the following year in the Second Valley Campaign brought Hayes a promotion to Brigadier General. He was always dedicated, energetic, gallant, and, by his own admission, lucky. When he left for war, he fiercely wished for a wound. He received 4, the worst being a broken arm caused by flying shrapnel. Hayes considered patriotism more desirable than life. In one engagement, he was leading a charge when he saw a fearful soldier about to break for the rear. The colonel pulled out his revolver and vowed that he would kill him on the spot if he did not go in and fight. The man regained control, returned to the battle, and was killed instantly. Hayes was glad to have given the soldier the death of a hero rather than that of a coward. One of his sergeants, future President William McKinley, wrote of Hayes, "His whole nature seemed to change with battle. From the sunny, agreeable, the kind, the generous, the gentle gentleman he was, when the battle was once on, intense and ferocious." Upon his return home from the war, Hayes became equally successful in politics. First a radical Republican congressman, 1865-67, then twice a reform governor, 1868-72 and 1876-77. He was a natural candidate for presidential nomination in 1876. His opponent was Samuel Tilden, the most popular Democrat since Andrew Jackson. The campaign itself, however, descended to new lows in mudslinging and dishonesty. Democrats spotlighted the long years of Republican corruption. Republicans countered with the slogan, "Not every Democrat was a rebel, but every rebel was a Democrat." Hayes promised to stress civil service reform and to end military occupation in the South. "There can be no enduring peace," he proclaimed, "if the constitutional rights of any portion of the people are permanently disregarded." In the election, Tilden won 300,000 more popular votes than Hayes. The all-important electoral vote, on the other hand, was 184 to 165, and another 20 votes in four states were disputed. Weeks of heated congressional vitriol eventually led to the creation of an electoral commission, consisting of 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats. Wholesale duplicity, intimidation, and even murder accompanied the commission's deliberations. An informal deal materialized. If the Democrats acquiesced to Hayes' election, Republicans would agree to withdraw troops from the ex-Confederacy. That would open the door for Democrats to establish anew their dominance of the South. At 4 a.m. on March 2, 1877, 2 days before the expiration of Grant's term, the commission, by an 8-7 vote, declared Hayes to be the next president. Nationwide, Democrats never forgave Hayes for stealing the presidency. Republicans never forgave him for allowing the South to form a solid bloc again. In his only major political mistake, Hayes rewarded with federal offices the 4 Louisiana Electoral College members who had arbitrarily given their state to the Republican candidate. Thereafter, Hayes had to weather a number of unflattering nicknames: Old 8-7, President De Facto, and His Fraudulency among them. Nevertheless, the highly moralistic Hayes was a more effective chief executive than his detractors claimed. He took office quietly and resolutely, the slanders and slurs of the campaign forgotten. Hayes immediately declared Reconstruction at an end, and in his strong cabinet, he put forth the name of an ex-Confederate. The president fought for and obtained presidential prerogatives that Congress had usurped since the post-Lincoln years. While Hayes was unable to drive a full program through Congress, he paved the way for a badly needed civil service overhaul. One writer concluded that Hayes's great contribution was to restore faith in the integrity of the Washington regime and to prove, despite the Grant orgy, that a Republican could be honest, courageous, and a roadblock to designing thieves. Never has the White House been as morally clean as it was in the Hayes years. Hymns, singing, and prayers were part of every day's agenda. The high-minded Hayes and his teetotaler wife, called Lemonade Lucy, set strict house rules: no alcohol, smoking, gambling, or dancing. After one official dinner, Secretary of State William Evarts commented, "It was a brilliant affair. The water flowed like champagne." Hayes deserved re-election in 1880, but from the start he had vowed to be a one-termer. He was grateful for making that promise. Midway through his tenure, he complained that the courage and generosity he had seen in his 23rd Ohio comrades had been lost in the unstable peace after the war. He added on another occasion, "I am heartily tired of this life of bondage, responsibility, and toil." Still, he left the government more prosperous than when he entered office. That in itself was a signal achievement. The soldier statesman retired to private life. Following a trip to Columbus and Cleveland, Hayes boarded a train on January 12, 1892, to return to his home in Fremont. He was stricken en route with severe chest pains. He died the following day of neuralgia of the heart. His body was eventually laid to rest in the state park established at his home. James Abram Garfield, a term too short. James Abram Garfield was the last of our log cabin presidents. He was also, like Abraham Lincoln, a chief executive who was assassinated during this period in our history. Yet there, the similarities end. Garfield's term in office is the second shortest on record, and his killer had no motivation beyond dreams of grandeur. While both deaths were tragic, Garfield's had the added burden of being utterly senseless. Born on the Ohio frontier, Garfield from birth came under the strong influence of the Campbellites, disciples of Christ. It was while he was a student at a Campbellite academy in Hiram, Ohio, that his faith accelerated. He possessed a keen intellect, a natural speaking ability, and a deeply implanted sense of right and wrong. After gaining a bachelor's degree from Williams College, he returned to the Hiram School to teach foreign languages. Garfield was only 26 when he became president of the Hiram Academy. Politics then beckoned. In 1859, the tall and handsome Garfield won election as a state senator, and his anti-slavery rhetoric brought him a wide reputation. With the advent of the Civil War, he organized a company of his students, and they volunteered en masse for Army service. The militarily untutored Garfield became Lieutenant Colonel of the 42nd Ohio, and by year's end, commanded the regiment. In a January 1862 skirmish at Middle Creek, Kentucky, Garfield's men scattered a ragtag Confederate force. This gave the Union control of the eastern half of Kentucky and brought Garfield a Brigadier General's commission. Ill health kept him in Washington for several months, where his radical Republican ear was ever alert. When Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, Garfield told a friend, "It is a strange phenomenon in the world's history when a second-rate Illinois lawyer is the instrument to utter words which shall form an epoch memorable in all future ages." Thanks to the influence of his friend, Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase, Garfield returned to the Western Theater and joined William Rosecrans' Army of the Cumberland. The two generals became close associates, despite Rosecrans' active Catholic faith and Garfield's aversion to papism. Soon Garfield became the Army's chief of staff. Although Garfield was remarkably thin-skinned and constantly sought approval at every level, he had strong feelings of how the war should be waged. Primary among them was the need to strike boldly against the enemy. Garfield grew restless as Rosecrans made sure his army was just perfect. His impatience would have been acceptable, but Garfield went beyond the chain of command and voiced discontent in personal letters to Secretary Chase. "Thus far, the general has been singularly disinclined to grasp the situation with a strong hand," Garfield stated. "I beg you to know that this delay is against my judgment." This betrayal of trust in a superior he was duty-bound to serve was a black mark on Garfield's record, even though Rosecrans' embarrassing defeat at the September 1863 Battle of Chickamauga justified Garfield's criticisms. 2 months later, Garfield resigned from the Army to accept election to Congress. He served in the House for 17 years, all the while gaining the attention and respect of his colleagues. By 1880, the Republicans were hopelessly split into two wings. Garfield became a dark horse candidate and won the nomination on the 34th ballot. The ensuing campaign against Democratic nominee Winfield Hancock was full of personal attacks and bitter recriminations. Out of the 9 million votes cast, Garfield won with a plurality of fewer than 2,000 votes, the closest popular margin of all presidential elections. The Electoral College vote was 214-155 for Garfield. On the day after the election, Garfield had the unprecedented position of being a member of the House of Representatives, a U.S. Senate appointee, and President-elect of the United States. The amiable Garfield found the highest office agonizing from the start. Applicants for government jobs were everywhere. Garfield always had trouble saying no to anyone, and fellow Republicans were pulling at him from opposite directions. At one point, Garfield shouted, "My God, what is there about this place that a man should ever want to get in it?" To add to his misery, long-standing party scandals, some of which touched Garfield personally, began to erupt. Garfield could have never guessed that one of the aspirants for a federal job was insane. At 9:30 a.m. July 2, 1881, after 4 months in office, the president walked into the Washington train station to travel to commencement ceremonies at his alma mater, Williams College. Secretary of State James G. Blaine was at his side when a shabbily dressed man walked up and shot Garfield twice from behind. The first bullet merely grazed his coat, but the second shot entered his back, fractured at least one rib, and lodged deep in his body. A physician rushed to the scene and assured the president that the wound was not serious. Garfield replied, "Thank you, doctor, but I am a dead man." Week after week, a dozen physicians probed with fingers and unsterilized equipment in search of the bullet. Meanwhile, because Garfield and Vice President Chester Arthur were political rivals who disliked each other, Garfield's advisors refused to allow Arthur to see the president or to assume any executive duties. Sweltering summer weather in Washington led to Garfield being taken in a specially designed railroad car to his home at Elberton on the New Jersey shore. Tracks were laid all the way to the front door. As the search for the bullet continued, Garfield was given morphine injections. Hypodermic needles had been in use for less than 5 years. Alexander Graham Bell, of telephone fame, had invented an electromagnetic metal detector, but no one on site understood the contraption. It failed to pinpoint the bullet because the bed springs interfered. Sepsis began to take its toll. Garfield became increasingly dazed and confused as the disease spread. The 79-day ordeal ended on September 19th, when the president died. He was 49. A postmortem examination located the bullet, at last, behind his pancreas. Garfield's funeral obsequies were reminiscent of those of Lincoln, but Garfield's presidency was too short for anyone to evaluate it. The second assassination of a president came not as a result of a protracted rebellion. It was the first in a pattern that would mark all the presidential murders that followed. A lone individual, overtaken by insanity, had taken it upon himself to correct what he knew was history's mistake. Charles Julius Guiteau, Murder for the People. One reason it's difficult to prevent assassination plots is that the people who hatch them think the infamy they achieve is worth whatever price they have to pay. Charles Julius Guiteau, certainly of unsound mind, had reached that conclusion when he shot President James A. Garfield. Guiteau, of French Huguenot extraction, grew up in an unstable family environment that shifted from Illinois to Wisconsin. In adulthood, he failed at every career he pursued: insurance salesman, self-educated lawyer, newspaperman, preacher, debt collector, and political activist. His marriage to a YWCA librarian provided clear evidence of his mental instability. During the 5 years she endured his cruelty, he locked her in closets, beat her, and dragged her around the house by the hair while shouting, "I am your master!" Shabbily dressed, with piercing eyes, a slanting forehead, and a feline walk, Guiteau exuded a furtive manner. In 1880, he got involved in politics. He originally favored Grant for president, but switched to Garfield's side. Guiteau harassed party bosses to let him give campaign speeches, and he finally got permission to address a small group of African Americans. The closeness of Garfield's victory convinced Guiteau that his one address provided the margin of victory. He thereupon requested the ambassadorship to France. The perpetual loser bombarded the White House and the State Department with letters and visits inquiring about his appointment. Finally, Secretary of State James G. Blaine wrote him, "Never bother me again about the Paris consulship so long as you live." The White House also barred him from entrance. One night, like a flash, Guiteau recalled he had an epiphany. If the president was out of the way, everything would go better. His motive was not personal. He likened it to removing the Indians to make way for settlers and railroads. He wanted to save the Republican Party, prevent another civil war, and respond to the dictates of God. "I acted upon the inspiration of the deity," he confessed. The 40-year-old Guiteau became joyfully focused on his mission. As he later told a jailer, "I thought, What a tremendous excitement it would create. And I kept thinking about it all the week. He borrowed $15 and bought a .44 caliber pistol with an ornate handle because it would later be attractive in a museum. The Smithsonian Institution subsequently photographed the gun, which then disappeared. Guiteau carefully prepared an address to the American people, outlining the reasons for killing Garfield. "The assassination is not murder," he declared. "It is a political necessity." On the morning of July 2, 1881, Guiteau was waiting at the train station when the presidential party entered the huge lobby. Guiteau walked up behind Garfield and shot him twice at a distance of 6 feet. A single policeman grabbed Guiteau while aides rushed to the fallen president. The assassin reveled in the publicity that followed. He demanded $25 for any photograph taken. The New York Herald eagerly published a hastily written, disjointed autobiography. Guiteau fully expected to be released as legally insane, whereupon he planned to run for the presidency by going on the lecture circuit to speak about politics and religion. He also announced from jail that he was looking for a wife, who had to be an elegant Christian lady of wealth, under 30, belonging to a first-class family. More than 170 prospective jurors were interviewed before an impartial dozen could be selected. The trial began on November 14th, 2 months after Garfield's death, and it lasted 8 weeks. The major question was Guiteau's sanity. His constant outbursts and interruptions reduced the courtroom at times to a circus. One physician after another testified that the accused was a morbid egotist, a moral monstrosity who is not only now insane, but was never anything else. The district attorney countered, "He is no more insane than I am." He got tired of the monotony of dead-beating. He wanted excitement of some kind, and he got it. Guiteau offered his own explanation. "The doctors killed Garfield. I just shot him." The jury deliberated only 1 hour before bringing in a guilty verdict. Guiteau bounded to his feet. "You are all low, consummate jackasses," he shouted. When the judge sentenced Guiteau to death, cheers erupted in the courtroom. To the end, the condemned man played his role to the hilt. He planned to appear at his execution dressed only in his underwear as a reminder of the crucifixion of Jesus. That fantasy was denied. Guiteau's request for a band to play at his hanging was similarly rejected. On June 30, 1882, a large crowd of newspapermen and curiosity seekers jammed the prison courtyard. Guiteau smiled and waved at the assemblage as he walked to the scaffold. Standing on the gallows, his hands bound in front of him, he read first from a Bible and then a few verses of poetry he had composed that morning. The hangman placed a black hood over his face. Guiteau was mumbling, "Glory, glory, glory," when the trapdoor dropped under his feet. Wild cheers exploded from the crowd. Of the four presidential assassinations in our history, Charles Guiteau lived the longest, 9 months, after his victim's death. During that time, he trotted out all of his mad dreams for public display, like the publicity hounds so well known today. In an era when America was changing from a nation of farmers to factory workers, this small man was able to rise out of the faceless crowd and make his chilling mark for all the wrong reasons. William McKinley, America's Sweetheart. In 1896, he seemed almost the ideal presidential candidate. 17-year-old school teacher when the Civil War opened, a major in Rutherford Hayes's 23rd Ohio, a congressman with long years of honorable service, a leader in the politically potent Buckeye State, and one who could bend like the willows in the winds of public opinion. William McKinley was so wedded to big business in an age of industrialization that he was known as the advance agent of prosperity and Napoleon of Protection. He was one of the few heads of state who maintained great rapport with his congressional colleagues. the Ohioan brought a substantial closing of the bloody gap between North and South, and he even managed to ease the distance between factions within his own Republican Party. America was prospering when he was elected, and McKinley pursued every impetus to make the nation the industrial power of the world. Like Lincoln, he kept an ear to the ground on public opinion, despite the warning from political boss Uncle Joe Cannon that he might get grasshoppers as a result. Because McKinley was willing to listen, he never made a hasty decision. He was widely known for being amiable, courteous, and impeccably dressed. Dignity and girth added inches to his short frame. McKinley never allowed himself to be seen in disarray. He was a heavy cigar smoker, but not in public, for fear of being a corruptible influence on the young. Several times a day, he would change his white vests when they wrinkled. So great was his self-control that he seemed not to perspire during the muggiest Washington weather. That he was also a warm family man was common knowledge. He carefully watched over his epileptic wife, Ida. After saying, "I do, so help me God," at his 1897 inaugural, he leaned over and kissed his mother. As a person, he was probably the most beloved president thus far. Ironically, given that McKinley was such a kind and gentle man, he is remembered primarily for taking the country into the Spanish-American War. He was no warmonger. "I have been in one war," he said in 1898, "and I do not want to see another." But he was a keen interpreter of public wants. The people, not the president, held the ultimate authority. The masses were eager for war with Spain to establish an overseas empire. McKinley balked and had to take sleeping powders to overcome the stress. Theodore Roosevelt, who did everything in extremes, snarled that McKinley was a white-livered cur with no more backbone than a chocolate éclair. A fight-thirsty Congress passed the necessary declaration of war, and America's possessions soon extended across the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii and the Philippines. Flanked by an able Secretary of State, John Hay, McKinley made the United States an active force in world leadership for the first time. It also made McKinley a shoo-in for re-election in 1900. McKinley developed a good technique when he had to do mass handshaking. He would smile, grab the guest's right hand, squeeze it quickly. By holding the person's elbow with his left hand, he could pull him along and smile at the next person in line. Such greeting was taking place on September 6, 1901, at the Great Pan-American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. The president was shaking hands in a hall with a long line of people. An aide told McKinley that there wasn't time to meet them all. "Well," McKinley replied, "they'll all know I tried." Around 4:15, a man approached with his right hand in a handkerchief. He was dressed in plain clothes and had a childish expression on his face. McKinley courteously extended his left hand to greet him. The handkerchief fell away. A .32-caliber pistol fired two shots. McKinley slumped to the floor as the gunman stood rooted to the spot. A host of bystanders pounced on the gunman and, after disarming him, began flailing at him with fists. McKinley said as loud as he could, "Don't let them hurt him." It took a while for medical assistance to arrive. Physicians determined that one bullet had been deflected by a button, but another had cut a path through the president's stomach and lodged somewhere in the muscles of the back. A surgeon later sutured the two holes in the stomach, but did not remove the bullet. The use of antiseptics lay in the future. McKinley was alert and cheerful for the next several days. He then began to have difficulty eating. The area along the bullet's track had become infected. On the morning of September 13th, his condition turned critical. That evening, McKinley began murmuring his favorite hymn, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." He died of sepsis at 2 a.m. the following day. His body lay in state in the East Room of the White House prior to burial in Canton, Ohio. One biographer concluded, "He stood at the top of American politics as a result of his own masterful skill and because he was as much the dominant political personality of his time as Franklin Roosevelt would become in the 1930s. He was the last Civil War veteran to serve as president. With his passing also ended the domination of Civil War forces, the mushrooming industrial might that had created a country of haves and have-nots on an unprecedented scale, would be halted by the reforms of McKinley's successor, Theodore Roosevelt, the nation's next great president after Lincoln. America was entering a new century in which its concerns encompassed the entire world. Leon Czolgosz, Anarchism in Action. Of all the presidential assassins, Leon Czolgosz, pronounced Czolgosz, had the clearest motive. He hated the politics of state-supported capitalism. As America emerged from its cocoon to take its place on the world stage, strange terms like communism and proletariat migrated from Europe to inspire industrial workers in the United States. When viewed in this context, the eruption of such a madman does not seem as strange. Similarities exist between Garfield murderer Guiteau and McKinley assassin Czolgosz. Both men were of questionable sanity. Both were failures in the normal avenues of life. Both became disillusioned with and resentful of American society. Both had a burning desire for notoriety and concluded that killing the President of the United States would unquestionably make a somebody out of a nobody. Czolgosz was the same age as the man he murdered. Born to poverty-stricken parents in Michigan, he received little education because he had to begin working at the age of 10. His mother died in childbirth soon thereafter. His stepmother and his rigidly Catholic father bullied him throughout his youth. Such abuse affected his emotional development, and he slowly became a recluse. Though unsociable, he was never quarrelsome. At one point, he suffered a nervous breakdown. Czolgosz despaired constantly of his lowly station in life. He developed into a clean-shaven, bright-looking man. No record of any romantic relationships exist. Moving from one short-term job to another, the rudderless Czolgosz almost naturally drifted into anarchism. He read radical newspapers and magazines while occasionally attending socialist meetings. Czolgosz listened intently to such radicals as Emma Goldman and Emil Schilling, who railed against America's wealthy enriching themselves at the expense of the poor. The jobless Pole came to believe that all rulers were the enemies of the people, and that because the United States was the most powerful industrial nation in the world, its lower classes were forever doomed to poverty. The federal government was to blame for such inequity. Late in July 1900, newspapers announced the assassination of King Umberto I of Italy. His killer stated that he did the deed for the sake of the common man. Czolgosz now saw his destiny. "I thought it would be a good thing for the country," he concluded, "to kill the president." Czolgosz knew what he wanted to do, just as he knew he would die if he succeeded. Yet his sacrifice might bring America to its senses in terms of social fairness. He spent a year contemplating how and when he could act. The opportunity came in September 1901. When President McKinley would be attending the Pan American Exhibition in Buffalo, New York. Czolgosz traveled there and purchased a short-barreled revolver, which could be easily hidden in his large hand. On the second day of the exposition, he patiently waited in line to see McKinley. As Czolgosz walked forward, the president extended his hand. The anarchist slapped it away and fired twice. "I done my duty," he yelled before the crowd subdued him. He later confessed, "I don't believe one man should have so much service and another man should have none." His trial began 9 days after McKinley's death. Court-appointed attorneys asked for a delay. They could not make a case because Czolgosz refused to talk with them. The motion was denied and the trial was short. A jury deliberated merely an hour before sentencing Czolgosz to death. The shackled and heavily guarded prisoner was taken by train to Auburn Prison, New York. A large and angry mob waited at the station. Czolgosz was attacked and beaten before additional police officers hustled him inside the safety of the prison. The warden allowed no visitors during the ensuing month as preparations were made for execution by a method only 10 years old, electrocution. Czolgosz resigned to his fate, made no statements, and displayed no emotion. On October 29, 1901, guards awakened him from a sound sleep and led him to the electric chair next door. At 7:12 a.m., Czolgosz reportedly muttered a curse just before the first of two jolts of 1,700 volts coursed through his body. A special grave in the prison cemetery had been prepared. It was vented because, just before interment, authorities poured sulfuric acid into the coffin to hasten decomposition. Within 12 hours, nothing was left of Leon Czolgosz. He remains the most obscure of presidential assassins, but his motives, as demented as they were, sprang from a wellspring shared by many at the time. In 1904, muckraker Ida Tarbell published The History of the Standard Oil Company, detailing its monopolistic practices, and 2 years later, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle showed the world the horrors of Chicago's stockyards. Within a span of 7 years, anarchists killed the president of France, the empress of Austria, the king of Italy, the prime minister of Spain, and the president of the United States. Amid the clamor for change, Leon Czolgosz ushered in a new era in his twisted fashion. Chapter 9, America Rising. In the short 35 years from Appomattox to the end of the 19th century, Americans settled half of their continent, laid out a vast railroad system, and became world leaders in the development and use of coal, oil, and metals. The Industrial Revolution, which began in the North in the 1830s, propelled the United States to third in manufacturing worldwide during the Civil War. The country surged into first place in the succeeding two decades. Fueling that growth were unknowns who took advantage of the tremendous spurt of wartime spending and became famous in the last half of the 19th century. The major industrialists in the Gilded Age were entrepreneurs in areas where many temptations were offered and few restraints imposed. While they behaved with becoming vulgarity, they were men of audacity and exploitative talents, shrewd, aggressive, insatiable. One writer concluded, "They directed the proliferation of the country's wealth, they seized its opportunities, they managed its corruption, and from them the whole era took its tone and color." Pioneering this new breed of executives was Andrew Carnegie. The undersized, ever-inventive Scotsman started in railroads, and during the war, he switched to telegraphs that relayed battle reports instantly. He was in England after the war when he met Henry Bessemer, and mass production of steel was born. From that time, he mounted the ladder of success so fast that it scorched the rungs. With the gigantic piles of money he amassed, Carnegie proved to be one of the greatest philanthropists the world has known. During the war, the North's growing strength was supported by sizable investments from private individuals. Rising to the top of the heap of frantic entrepreneurs were financial giants like Jay Gould and J.P. Jubilee Morgan. Gould's holdings expanded from his speculation in railroad stocks during the war until his vast empire encompassed 15,000 miles of American rails. In his early days, Morgan was not above war profiteering, but moved on to become legendary for his banking houses. Some of the Industrial Revolution's magnates just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Selling meat to the Union Army gave Philip Armour his start in what grew into a meatpacking empire based in Chicago. The working conditions at his stockyards became so onerous that a public outcry utterly disgraced him. His labor force was hardly alone in being mistreated during this unregulated era. The growth of industrial labor inevitably brought friction with corporate leadership. Unrest led to strikes, which usually ended in bloodshed. Detective Alan Pinkerton, on whom Lincoln depended for enemy intelligence during the war, proved adept at infiltrating bands of unhappy workers and alerting corporate heads of possible activity. The personification of progressivism, the individual who dominated the nation's rise to economic greatness, was John D. Rockefeller. The Civil War provided a boost for America's newest mass-market fuel, oil. With those gains, Rockefeller went on to create an empire unparalleled in its size. At the turn of the new century, when the average annual wage was $400, he became America's first billionaire. For the last 40 years of his life, however, he turned his prodigious energy to charity. Indeed, his legacy today stems almost as much from his philanthropy as from his empire building. Rockefeller's charity, while enormous, was matched by two humanitarians working alone but faithfully. Clara Barton began helping others on the battlefields of the Civil War, and that work became a lifetime crusade. An indomitable spirit who was unwilling to accept the strictures placed on women, she established the American Red Cross as a major relief agency for the needy. Reformer Frederick Douglass found that his cause did not take off so readily. Society is more difficult to spur to new heights than an industry. Well known for his abolitionist views prior to the war, Douglass continued his quest for the recognition of racial equality in the post-war years. His legacy influenced successors like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois as the nation struggled on how freed slaves would fit into the social order. This last legacy of the Civil War remains painfully unresolved to this day. Andrew Carnegie, King of Steel. His is the greatest rags-to-riches story in American history. Andrew Carnegie was born into poverty in Scotland. His father operated a hand loom until he lost his job to mechanization. The family then immigrated to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where young Andrew worked first as a bobbin boy in a textile factory and then as a telegrapher. In 1852, Thomas A. Scott, called the father of American railroading, offered Carnegie a job as a telegrapher and personal secretary for the Western Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Rail lines were the first big industry in America, and Pennsylvania had the largest. Scott gave Carnegie advice, experience, and the use of his extensive library. The young Scotsman accepted all of it. When Scott advanced to president of the line, he appointed Carnegie in his place with the Western Division. Carnegie's only participation in politics came during this period. His abolitionist views led him into the Republican Party. As a proponent of social equality, he wrote several editorials for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. Shortly after the Civil War began, Scott was named Assistant Secretary of War in charge of military transportation. He wisely brought in Carnegie to supervise telegraphic communications for Union detachments in the Washington area. Carnegie helped in repairs of the Annapolis-Washington line so federal regiments could reach the capital. Cut in the face while splicing wire, Carnegie received praise as being one of the war's first casualties. After collecting the best operators he could find, Carnegie helped establish the U.S. Military Telegraphic Corps. The speed that telegraph lines brought to widespread communication revolutionized the face of war. Like fellow businessman John D. Rockefeller, Carnegie then hired substitutes to avoid serving in the Army. Carnegie felt no shame remaining in civilian pursuits. He regarded himself a better patriot for improving railroads than he would be as another soldier in the ranks. Fame and fortune followed. While continuing work for the Pennsylvania Railroad, Carnegie invested $40,000 in the nascent Columbia Oil Company. 2 years later, the oil producer made more than $1 million in profits. In 1862, Carnegie organized the Keystone Bridge Company, which built the nation's first iron trestles. Wartime demands for armor, cannon, shells, and other iron products made Pittsburgh the center of the rapidly growing iron industry. Carnegie took advantage of the situation in 1864 by creating one iron company and buying another. His firm dominated the production of iron for railroad use in the immediate post-war years. In partnership with T.T. Woodruff and George Pullman, Carnegie contributed another improvement to railroads by designing an elegant sleeping car for overnight travelers. All this was prelude to the Great Leap to come. The Iron Master made a fateful trip to Europe in 1882. There he met English inventor Henry Bessemer, whom Carnegie initially thought was a crazy Frenchman. Bessemer had developed a process of forcing air through molten pig iron to produce white-hot steel. The 38-year-old Carnegie rushed home. The age of iron had passed. The blast furnace was now the way to go. "Give it 30,000 pounds of common pig iron," he exclaimed. And presto, the whole mass is blown into steel. The entrepreneur surrounded himself with capable assistants, negotiated for cheap railroad transport, and created the most efficiently operated steel plant under single management in the world. Carnegie's enterprise came to include steelmaking foundries, rolling mills, and bridge works. With headquarters in Pittsburgh and easy access to coal, oil, and the carbon fuel coke, Carnegie turned out steel in quantities that drove away competition. In one decade, steel production leaped from 26,600 tons to 500,000 tons. Expansion was continual and easy. The steel combine in which Carnegie held half interest was a private partnership, not a public corporation. Carnegie insisted that profits be plowed back into the business. By cost reduction, consolidation, and control of all the production stages, Carnegie reigned over the most extensive individually owned iron and steel operations ever. His annual income at a time of minimal taxation was $250 million by modern-day calculation. Yet his enormous wealth was only one asset of a man known for his charm, literary knowledge, and social graces. While much of his fortune came from in-house trading and manipulations, Carnegie was a missionary for financial responsibility and social benevolence. Those who became rich, Carnegie stated, were the best fitted for wealth because competition ensures the survival of the fittest in every department. In the first of two books he wrote, Triumphant Democracy, 1886, Carnegie thought American democracy was vastly superior in production methods than the English monarchy. His best-received volume, The Gospel of Wealth, 1889, argued that the wealthy should use their affluence to enrich all society. Much of his moral standing evaporated in the 1892 Homestead Strike, when laborers at one of his plants demanded higher wages. Bloody clashes followed with police and Pinkerton henchmen the company had hired. The plant reopened with immigrant employees known as scabs rather than plant workers. Carnegie's reputation was permanently damaged. The Homestead dispute led to a 1901 sellout by Carnegie to financial giant J. Pierpont Morgan. The $14 billion sale was the largest personal transaction in history. Carnegie's former empire became the United States Steel Corporation. While creating America's steel industry, Carnegie began making significant gifts to charity. He once declared in a memo to himself, "Man does not live by bread alone. My gifts have contributed to the enlightenment and joy of the mind, to all that tends to bring into the lives of the toilers sweetness and life. I hold this the noblest possible use of wealth." the business magnate donated more than $5 billion to worthwhile pursuits before his August 11, 1919 death from bronchial pneumonia. Another $30 million went to charities after Carnegie's passing. He was buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Tarrytown, Massachusetts. Motivated by the demands of the Civil War, Carnegie was a key figure in the emergence of post-war America as the world's greatest source of first iron and then steel. Among his enduring legacies are also public libraries, the Carnegie Institute of Technology, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, Carnegie Hall, Carnegie Mellon University, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association of America, now TIAA-CREF. Jason J. Gould, Pacemaker for Greed. Following the war, a new class of super-rich industrialists made stupendous fortunes by any standards. No one was more corrupt and exploitive than Jason J. Gould. He parlayed his winnings on the fate of Union battles to amass an initial fortune. From that foundation, he wheeled and dealed his way to America's greatest railroad speculator and developer. Born in Roxbury, New York, he was largely self-educated, schooling himself in surveying and mathematics. His first hint of shrewdness came when he was barely 20. He began his career in a Pennsylvania tanning business, bought out his partners, and gained a modicum of prosperity. In 1859, Gould became enamored with the burgeoning railroad field and began purchasing stock in small companies. For Gould, the Civil War was a business opportunity to be fully exploited. He paid government agents to inform him of Union victories or defeats before news became public. He could then anticipate stock market reactions and reap large profits. In one instance, he bought control of a line by purchasing stock at 10 cents on the dollar. The line later flourished, and so did Gould. Beginning in 1867, Gould became the terror of Wall Street, joining financiers Cornelius Vanderbilt and Daniel Drew to gain control of the Erie Railroad, the East Coast's major carrier. Gould was named president of the company the following year. He was not an impressive-looking executive. Undersized in body and maintaining a full beard, he was normally reserved in manner and gave only a fleeting smile. His large, dark eyes were piercing. His intense concentration gave off a demonic energy. Gould's manipulative ways came into full view when he appointed New York political leader William Boss Tweed as director of the Erie Line. Tweed, in turn, arranged legislation favorable to Gould. The two became wrathful targets for the press and cartoonist Thomas Nast. The New York World called him the Little Wizard of Wall Street. The New York Times went further. Of His Majesty J. Gould, the paper suggested, it may be time that 50 millions of Americans will allow Mr. Gould's foot to rest on their neck. Never did Gould evince any interest in running a railroad. He enjoyed manipulating stock through what today is called insider trading. He was, on the one hand, a speculator who bought and sold stocks by guessing their future prices, and on the other hand, a manipulator who caused stock prices to fluctuate for his personal gain. Using stocks from his own companies, Gould persuaded sympathetic banks to finance his activities, and always he offered bribes to men in politics, justice, and other high places. All this became evident in 1868, when, with Daniel Drew and James Jubilee Jim Fisk, Gould countered an attempt by Vanderbilt to seize control of the Erie Railroad. Gould engaged in a number of outrageous schemes. Among them, he issued 100,000 shares